firefighters continue to gain ground on the large fire near Superior. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a new $2 million grant to help Montana college students become entrepreneurs. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with the winner of this year's Aldo Leopold Award, wildlife scientist Dr. Joel Berger. Crews continue to make progress on the 4,500-acre West Mullen Fire near Superior, and some evacuated homeowners are being allowed to go back home. West Mullen Road is open to the public east of Sunflower Lane, and west of Sunflower Lane is open to residents only. Flat Creek Road within the city limits is open, as is East Mullen Road. Flat Creek Road outside the city limits remains closed and under mandatory evacuation. Pardee Creek, Keystone Creek, and La Vista Roads and Big Eddy Fishing Access also remain closed. Fire Information Officer Greg D. Nitto says nearly 600 firefighters are now working to contain the fire.
Continuing to do mop-up outside of Superior, just outside of Superior and along the Mullen Road. They have been doing some work up Flat Creek, further up Flat Creek, to bring the fire back down to the road the rest of the way, and hopefully be able to hold that side. They are also doing some work on the western side above Keystone Creek, where they're doing allowing the fire to move down the slope, doing a little touch-up with putting some fire down to just kind of touch up the edges of the fire, keep it clean so it doesn't have a lot of unburnt fuel behind the main line, and then that takes off altogether.
There will be a community meeting about the fire tonight at 8 o'clock at the Mineral County Courthouse. Meanwhile, the Gold Creek Fire burning north of Missoula remains at 170 acres. Ground crews and helicopters continue to make progress on that lightning-caused fire.
Federal officials have announced a new federal, local, and private partnership to help reduce the risk of wildfires that could threaten western water supplies and hydroelectric facilities. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell and Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack were in northern Colorado for the announcement today of the Western Watershed Enhancement Partnership. The U.S. Forest Service and U.S. Bureau of Reclamation are launching the partnership with a pilot project in the Upper Colorado Headwaters and Big Thompson Watershed in northern Colorado, where a destructive fire burned last year. In the pilot, the Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District and Colorado State Forest Service will work with the federal agencies on forest thinning, prescribed burns, and restoring burned forests near reservoirs and dams. The federal agencies are working on similar arrangements around the West.
Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is limiting fishing hours on several rivers due to lower flows and warmer temperatures. The fishing closures between 2 p.m. and midnight will take effect Monday on portions of the Dearborn, Smith, and Sun Rivers, along with the Lower Madison and Upper Big Hole Rivers. FWP orders hoot owl closures when maximum water temperatures reach at least 73 degrees for three consecutive days. The preferred water temperature for rainbow and brown trout is about 56 degrees.
And in other news from around the state, government and higher education leaders are announcing a three-year, $2 million grant to expand entrepreneurship through the state's two largest universities. The grant from the Blackstone Charitable Foundation will be split between the University of Montana and Montana State University. The money will staff an office on each campus seeking to connect students interested in starting a business with supportive network to help turn those ideas into sustainable companies. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us Montana joins several other states who have received similar grants.
University of Montana Computer Sciences senior Josh Austin is packed into the Capitol Rotunda with a group of other students who came over for the unveiling of this entrepreneurship grant. About half the students, like Josh, are wearing maroon UM shirts, the other half blue and gold Montana State University shirts. Josh is exactly the kind of guy this grant is targeting. Last year, he and a couple of other students started a company called Mobile Minds.
And our goal in the long term is developing a new way to educate people with iPad devices in the classroom.
He's looking for help in getting it off the ground.
We know about our entrepreneurial spirit. Now Blackstone knows about that.
Senator John Tester speaking at the Capitol unveiling. Colorful lights and banners are hanging around him. Five big flat-screen TVs, all to announce Montana's new Blackstone Launchpad Initiative.
The goal here is to keep homegrown talent right here at home.
The $2 million comes from the charitable foundation of the multinational investment firm Blackstone Financial. With the money, the UM and MSU campuses each set up one of these Blackstone launch pads in their respective university centers, a place where a university student, any students with business ideas can come in and the office will connect them with people in that industry, other local entrepreneurs, and venture coaches across a vast network assembled by Blackstone. Blackstone Financial President Tony James owns a ranch near Twin Bridges. He says Senator Tester asked him to take part in a small business opportunity workshop about a year ago. He says that led to him wanting to include Montana in the Launchpad program.
We agreed with the President of the United States that we would do this in only six states. And we're in California, we'll be shortly, we're in Pennsylvania, we're in Florida, we're in Ohio. Why Montana? Well, first of all, your entrepreneurial spirit. It's unusual.
He also says he has yet to see a state with politicians so unified in their support for the idea. Several others were present for the announcement. Senator Max Baucus, Governor Steve Bullock.
I think the project really recognizes not just what Montana is today, but what more that we truly can become.
As well as University of Montana President Roy Singstrom and Montana State University President Wahed Cruzado.
Provide an invaluable doorway for our students to access the collective insights of other entrepreneurs connected to Blackstone across the nation.
The Launchpad offices are modeled after a program developed at the University of Miami in 2008. A press release from Blackstone says that program has created almost 1,500 business proposals and more than 200 jobs. The release also claims the Montana Launchpads could potentially generate some 150 new ventures in the state in the next 5 years. Senator Tester says the initiative will need to raise $600,000 more from the private sector in order to fund the program for its full 3-year initial run. Student Josh Austin is excited to hear about all of it.
But I'm trying to set up and go talk to me as soon as possible because I can see just trying to figure out how to grow, how to move the company, looking at moving, hiring employees, but we don't have the structure for that.
University officials say they expect the Launchpad offices to open in a few months. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The families of the hikers who were injured by a lightning strike in Glacier National Park are grateful to other park visitors who performed CPR and called for medical help. Travis Heitman of Kalispell, Kenzie Leishman of Missoula, and 11-year-old boy Heitman is mentoring are hospitalized in Kalispell and recovering from injuries suffered in the strike late Wednesday afternoon. Kenzie's father, Jason Leishman of Houston, says the last thing any of the three remembers is they were hustling back to the vehicle because a storm was coming. A pediatrician was among the first hikers to come upon the three. Travis's father, Kent Heitman, says all three are hurting and have been sleeping a lot. Jason Leishman says they're sore, shook up, and still a bit confused.
About 75 people gathered in Anaconda's Washoe Park for a candlelight vigil for a 3-year-old Washington State boy who was killed July 8th, about 5 miles south of Anaconda. Broderick Kramer's father, Jeremy Kramer, is charged with deliberate homicide and jailed on $250,000 bail. Two local pastors officiated yesterday's ceremony, organized by Amy Nichols and Rebecca Gallagher of Anaconda. Anaconda resident Melissa Penner said she was there because she wanted to support Brody's mother. Penner's son, Tyler Kelly, and Brody were just born days apart. Children brought stuffed animals and toys that will be sent to Brody's mother. Nichols says flowers donated for the service will be placed at the spot where Brody's body was found. U.S. Bank has set up a Natalie and Brody Kramer Fund to accept donations.
Montana's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate held steady at 5.4% in June. The national rate was also steady at 7.6%. Labor Commissioner Pam Busey says private employers added 2,300 jobs in June, but government job losses resulted in a gain of only 100 jobs for overall payroll employment. Busey says Montana's economy got back on track in April, May, and June after a slow first quarter. She says the state has added 1,700 jobs in the past 3 months and 6,000 over the past year. Montana's June 2012 unemployment rate was 6.1%.
Montana's pension funds have returned to their pre-recession market value. The State Board of Investments learned yesterday that the state's 9 pension funds posted a net gain of just over 13% for the fiscal year ending in June 30th, and now have a total of $8.54 billion. The funds were valued at $8.5 billion in October 2007, before losing a quarter of their value in the 2008 financial meltdown. Board of Investments Executive Director David Ewers tells Lee Newspapers of Montana that the funds benefited from strong stock market returns. They were valued at $7.58 billion a year ago. Before the 2013 legislature convened, the funds had a combined potential shortfall of $4.3 billion. Lawmakers passed bills to slightly increase contributions and a slightly reduce benefits paid by the pension plans.
U.S. Senator John Tester says the Democratic Party can win the Senate seat being vacated by Max Baucus, but it's going to take a lot more work now that former Governor Brian Schweitzer isn't running. Tester said today that Schweitzer was the Democrats' best chance of winning the 2014 election, and he probably could have won without Tester's help. But Tester says there are potential candidates in the state legislature, administration, and the private sector who can win if they're willing to do the work. Schweitzer announced last Saturday that he would not run next year, saying he didn't want to leave Montana for Washington, D.C. His announcement prompted speculation the former governor was discouraged by party infighting. Tester says he and his staff did nothing to inhibit Schweitzer from running.
In 1985, the conductor of the University of Montana and Missoula Mendelssohn Choirs toured Europe performing with other choirs from around the world. Donald Carey invited the choirs he was performing with to come west. 2 years later, Missoula hosted its first international choral festival. Reporter Ruth Eddy has more on the festival that aims to bring the world a little closer through music.
This year's International Choral Festival has choirs from 12 countries, including Taiwan, Poland, and Estonia. Executive Director for the festival, Melissa Blunt, says Missoula's festival stands out for many around the world.
Most of the festivals around the world are competitive, and so they don't have an opportunity to socialize with the choirs like they do here. Usually they're competing with them.
Two Australian girls teach a handful of Canadian youth an Aboriginal dance outside a rehearsal space. Megan Shaw, one of the teachers from Melbourne, says she prefers singing in other languages.
We sing German for one of our songs. You get to walk up to the German people and be like, how do I say these words? Because I have no idea. And then you like make some friends because of that. Yeah. And that dance that we do, like everybody really wants to learn it. So you make friends by teaching them, and then they teach us things as well. So.
Shaw raved about the homemade burgers her host family cooked last night for dinner, which is another reason Blunt says the Missoula Festival is unique.
And here, they're fully hosted, they're driven around by the host families, they're taken around and shown the sights, and they have potlucks at night, and they become part of the family for a week.
Over 200 Missoulians volunteered to host, cook, and chauffeur their singers around. Mary Laporte is hosting for the first time this year and has three Costa Ricans.
Oh, it's so much fun. We dance, we sing, we have meals. They're just really great people. It's a big commitment, but it's a big reward.
Laporte has even picked up some Spanish.
Los gentes son muy simpáticos y maravillosos.
The festival takes a lot of planning and fundraising, which is why it only happens every 3 years. Blunt says she's always moved by the humanity and the beauty of the songs.
People of all nationalities and languages come together and they share this universal language of music, and that is just heartwarming.
Phoebe Evans says it took 2 days of travel to get from Australia to the U.S. Her choir also performed in Idaho's Choral Festival last week and says she wishes she could stay longer.
I don't know, it's being around so many other people that love the same thing you do, just love singing, and so it's just being around them like makes you even more passionate. I really think it's great.
The festival continues this evening and through tomorrow around Missoula. You can find more information and a complete schedule at choralfestival.org. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Ruth Eddy.
A professor at the University of Montana has won this year's prestigious Aldo Leopold Award from the American Society of Mammalogists for his contribution to the conservation of mammals and their habitats. Dr. Joel Berger is a senior scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society and holds the John J. Craighead Chair of Wildlife Conservation at UM. His research has taken him from Africa to the Arctic, studying everything from rhinos to muskox. He will also head up a new study of Rocky Mountain goats in Glacier National Park. In tonight's feature interview, Berger talks with News Director Sally Mock about that goat research and about his recent trip to Bhutan, where he was studying their national mammal.
Unlike in the U.S., we have no national mammal. They have had one for almost 30 years. It's called a takin. And it's interesting because takin are the forerunners of muskox, which we have here in the Arctic, of course, but also somewhat related to mountain goats.
Related how? An ancestor? Or
Yeah. So they were they're an earlier species, and then they had several different lineages of which mountain goats broke off and, of course, are only here in North America.
And why are they worthy of study?
Given that they're the national mammal of Bhutan, Bhutan knows very little about their takin. They've asked us here at the University of Montana to help coordinate conservation programs, which means that we need to know something about the science and generate some science. And we're doing it in conjunction with Bhutanese colleagues because they don't yet have the infrastructure. So we're serving as advisors, but they're doing the field work. But I'm doing field work there too, of course.
Are they threatened?
Not much is known, and so we don't know if their populations are going up, stable, going down, but they do have a dubious distinction. Low elevation, they're preyed on by tigers. High elevation, they're preyed on by snow leopards, and so it's like a double whammy for them. And there are these bizarre forest, herd-living, 800-pound, beautifully colored, mysterious animals.
Bigger than mountain goats.
Twice the size of mountain goats, but very nimble still on cliffs.
You are also going to be studying mountain goats in Glacier National Park. And one of the reasons for the study, I gather, is because the Park Service is concerned about increasing interaction between goats and humans in the park.
In the park, there are really two issues. There's always a safety issue with the public. And then secondarily, there's the Going to the Sun Highway. And we know very little about its effect on wildlife, and in particular on goats. And so the study that we're involved in conducting is really two-faced. One is to understand a little bit more about the ecology of goats, because very little is known. Of course, our eminent Chadwick wrote a book on them, 30 years ago, and has continued to follow goats, but not that much is really known. And then the second issue, in addition to the road, is, of course, a human safety issue, because there was a person, most regrettably, killed over in Olympic National Park
about three years ago, a hiker. And he was killed when he was trying to get the goat off the trail, and he had sent the people who were hiking with him down the trail while he did that and was gored.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was gored in the leg. It was a remarkably unfortunate circumstance. It was a goat that had become habituated, either used to looking for salts or some sort of human handouts. And when animals become habituated, they can become a little bit more dangerous. But yes, he had sent his hiking party out ahead and tried to deter the goat and get around it, and he was gored in the femoral.
Goats in Glacier have been studied before, and that ended tragically for the goats. There were two goats who died from being tranquilized.
Mm-hmm. I was involved in that. I was the PI, principal investigator, on that. And through a series of learning experiences, which were unfortunate because goats should not die, and they did. We used some experimental drugs because we had a problem transporting across the airlines the drugs that have been used for more than 350 mountain goats safely in the past. And so as a consequence that we could not transport, and I'm not blaming the airlines, it's a very complicated thing when one uses opioid drugs. We had a veterinarian from the Bronx Zoo who was very, very good, but the drugs that we ended up using had only been used on 9 goats in history. In the past, from what we can tell.
And it didn't work.
It was an unfortunate combination of the two drugs. It killed the first two goats. We called a halt to the project. The park superintendent, Chaz Cartwright, certainly agreed with the decision. It was unfortunate for everybody. And we learn from mistakes and move forth.
anyone who goes to Glacier on any sort of regular basis has an interaction with goats. They're ubiquitous at the pass, especially, which is one of the most visited, it probably is the most visited part of the park. But I haven't heard of any particularly serious encounter of goats and humans where humans have felt threatened by the goats, for example.
At this point, we're trying to get a better handle on the nature of the interactions between people and goats. Occasionally, Park Service does a little bit of hazing of goats. This includes yelling or moving aggressively toward the goats to move them away so that they do not become overly habituated. I'm not sure what overly really means. But on the other hand, no, there haven't been, to our knowledge, serious injuries to people. But we're just trying to get a better handle on a couple of issues. And the first is, of course, the human safety issue. But the second is maybe an indirect effect, by which I mean if goats are congregating unnaturally in parking lots or accessing human food or human products one way or another, they may be having inadvertent effects on vegetation. They may be moving away from the backcountry to the front country, so to speak. And so we're just trying to really understand a little bit more directly what the roads and what the people mean to goats. And of course, in the long term, is this going to have any kind of an impact on the population level of the goats?
You will also be studying climate change impacts on the goats as well as you have studied climate change on other mammals, I think muskox in the Arctic mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. on. Will you be studying that as well in Glacier?
It's relatively easy to add a number of variables to the study. For instance, once we know where goats are, and those are, as you pointed out, Sally, easy to find, certainly in the Logan Pass area, but we can have different kinds of recording information out there so we know what solar radiation is, and so we know what precipitation patterns are. We know whether they're on north slopes or south slopes, what kind of vegetation they're using. And so these are very easy attributes to gather. And so, yes, we will be doing that, although the primary purpose of the study, as I indicated, is direct and indirect effects of roads and people. But certainly to ignore the changing glacial scene that's going on up there and to look at how this may redistribute goats, it would be remiss for us not to take that approach.
You've written that one of your goals as a conservation scientist is to, quote, maintain what we have and restore what we've lost. How's that going?
We have some good stories to add. I think there's a lot of doom and gloom out there in the world, and you know, we certainly have high levels of human population and some resource crunches that come when everybody wants to live like Americans do, which is understandable. But even if we look in our backyard, we have more cougars now than we had 30 years ago, grizzly bears, wolves, black-footed ferrets, California condors. We've seen a number of initiatives. They take time. They cause a little bit of angst with some of the public. But overwhelmingly, the American public has supported this through initiatives and through legislation. And we're doing reasonably well compared to a lot of other countries. Yes, I like maintaining what we have and the opportunities when it's reasonable and not draconian on human livelihoods to bring things back.
Because you've also said, quote, humanity's callousness is frightening.
We are a consumer world, not just the U.S., but the world. And I heard on NPR today about a Chinese 25-year-old fellow in Inner Mongolia who paid $900-some thousand for a Maserati. There's a lot of consumerism, and somewhere the extreme variance that we see in the world, if we want, I think, a better world for all people, we need to narrow that. And that comes not without a cost.
We have been speaking with Dr. Joel Berger, who is the John J. Craighead Chair of Wildlife Conservation at UM, also a scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society, and also the winner of this year's Aldo Leopold Award, honoring your contribution to the conservation of mammals and their habitats. Well-deserved award. Congratulations on that.
Sally, it's always wonderful to work with you and to work with NPR.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight expect clear skies with lows in the upper 40s. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with highs in the mid 80s to lower 90s. Sunday will be clear. Highs will be in the upper 80s to mid 90s. For central Montana, tonight will be mostly clear with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be around the upper 50s. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs will be in the upper 80s. Sunday expect mostly clear skies with highs around 80 to 90 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight expect mostly clear skies with lows around 45 to 60 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with highs in the upper 80s. Sunday calls for mostly clear skies with highs around 80 to 90 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Terry Kendrick.
For those of you who know me, you know that I am one of the least athletic people you are ever likely to meet. I don't have good vision in one eye, so I have no depth perception. I'm not fast or strong. I've long said that my two best sports were bowling and bingo. However, I've always been a sports fan. I remember when Bob Gibson pitched for the St. Louis Cardinals in the World Series in 1968. I knew everything there was to know about pro basketball in the early 70s. I marked a spot on my bedroom wall so I could see how tall Lew Alcindor, soon to be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, really was. I mourned the fact that he left the Milwaukee Bucks and went to the Los Angeles Lakers. In the 80s, I watched tennis every time Martina Navratilova played, and though my heart will always belong to Martina, I still get up in time for breakfast at Wimbledon and the French Open. In the 90s, I screamed at the TV during women's college basketball finals and would occasionally have to leave the room because I couldn't bear to watch. A perfect weekend for me, even now, involves getting in a little TV time to watch Tiger play golf. All of this preamble is to give myself some street cred in the sports world, even if it is only through a television screen. ESPN is showing 9 documentaries about women in sports. The series is titled 9 for 9 and celebrates the 40th anniversary of the landmark Title IX decision, the passage of the federal law that prohibits sex discrimination in education. The films are about women and directed by women. The subjects vary from the woman who is training to make the world's deepest free dive to 561 feet, to the treatment of women reporters in locker rooms. Last night, I watched the film about Pat Summitt, the coach of the University of Tennessee women's basketball team, the Lady Volunteers. Pat Summitt ranks second to UCLA's John Wooden for winning the most NCAA championships. She holds the record for winning the most games in the NCAA. Pat's father, a classic, hardworking, demanding, and stoic man of his generation, moved the family to another county so that Pat could play basketball in high school in the 1960s. She was co-captain of the women's Olympic basketball team in 1976, the first year the sport was in the Olympics, and the team won a silver medal. 8 years later, she coached the women's team to an Olympic gold medal. Just to give you an idea of how things were in women's sports when Pat became the head coach of the Lady Volunteers in 1974, she washed the uniforms herself, they only had one set, purchased with the proceeds from a donut sale the year before, drove the van to out-of-town games, and made $250 a month coaching. When she started, women's basketball wasn't part of the NCAA. She pushed for recognition of the sport. She held her players to high standards on and off the court. In her 37 years of coaching, she had 100% college graduation rate among her players. Basketball was important, but their education was more important. The basketball court for Pat Summitt represented a level playing field. You couldn't bring your disadvantaged or your privileged background to the court. Not only was she an incredibly successful coach, but she appears to have been a great mother. She raised her son on the basketball court. She didn't sacrifice her career or her child's life. They were both important, and they both had her attention. There is a great photo of her in the locker room with her baby over her shoulder as she's drawing out plays on the chalkboard. The word that comes to mind for me when I think of Pat Summitt is uncompromising. Today, that word has bad connotations. You can't get things done unless you compromise. You have to give a little to be able to get a little. She did not compromise her values. She had lightning clarity about what she wanted to accomplish and what she felt her players could accomplish. Pat Summitt says she wouldn't have made it to the top without people. That simple statement belies the true genius of it. Of course you can't coach without people. Who would you coach? But there's a reason Pat Summitt and John Wooden occupy the rarefied atmosphere of coaches with the most wins. They marshaled their energy toward a single purpose, to demand the best of themselves and their players every single day. Pat recognized people's talents and helped them step into their own greatness. She taught people not to back away from success, but to move toward it. We could all benefit from her tenacity and sense of purpose. It's a cruel twist of fate that this smart, strategic, dedicated woman has early onset dementia. But in true Pat Summitt style, she's stepping into this next uncertain phase of her life with grace and conviction. She started the Pat Summitt Foundation for Researching Alzheimer's. This is Terry Kendrick. Thanks for listening.
Terry Kendrick is one of several commentators in Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetic.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.